Night Football. In the NBA, the Bucks and Bulls both off last night. Tonight, the Bucks host Denver. The Bulls are off. The NHL, the Blackhawks beat Minnesota 3-1. They are off tonight. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Monday, November 19th. Partly sunny for the morning, cloudy for the afternoon, a high of 37. Quick heads up, 50-50 chance of some light snow cropping up after midnight tonight, a low of 22. Tomorrow, Tuesday, sunny and 33. New numbers are in, not much change. 24 degrees Racine, 22 in Kenosha, wind from the southwest at 8. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. The unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees, transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we'll talk to the author of a brand new novel, an incredible thriller called Ask No Mercy. In part two, in anticipation of the Thanksgiving holiday, we think about gratitude. Stay with us. We're going to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking with a very talented Swedish writer by the name of Martin Österdahl. He's actually been an award-winning director for a number of years, but now is taking on new undertakings as a writer, and very obviously a gifted one. The book that we're going to be talking about, a novel called Ask No Mercy, the first in a series of books around a character named Max Enger, has been a huge success in Sweden and in areas beyond, and as a matter of fact is soon going to be transformed into a major television series. And one of the things that makes this book particularly interesting is because it largely involves the nation of Russia, where the author, Martin Österdahl, spent some years studying. And so he has long been intrigued by the nation of Russia, and particularly the volatile period of the mid to late 1990s. And that is the time period in which this thriller is based. And this novel has recently been translated into English and is now available to American readers. And I'm excited about the possibility of talking now with Martin Österdahl about Ask No Mercy, published by Amazon. And Martin Österdahl, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much.
So first of all, tell us about your career ahead of being a writer. Explain to us the kind of things that you have directed and the ways in which that earlier work has led to this new undertaking for you.
Well, I started out working in media and media management, and then I started producing television shows. And most of the television shows I've been involved in have been entertainment shows, so music, big sort of music-based entertainment shows, which, you know, quite different from writing novels, obviously. But I've also worked a lot with as a director of television at the national TV station SVT in Sweden, and of course overseeing production of all sorts of genre. And I guess that at the bottom of it all lies a great interest and passion for storytelling. And, you know, no matter what kind of TV shows or books you produce, the heart of the matter is always a great story.
Hmm. So what was it that brought you to Russia, where you did some studying? First of all, what age were you at the time, and what exactly were you studying, and why in Russia?
Well, my first experience with the East was when I was at school. As a young boy, I was fortunate enough to go to a special music school, so I did a lot of singing. I sang at the Royal Opera House in Stockholm, and we traveled with the choir, with the opera choir, to behind the Iron Curtain, as it was at the time. So I got to tour in East Berlin, in the Czech Republic, and in Hungary, places like that, which was something that not many people in my age was able to do, obviously, because during this time, Europe was sealed, and that part of Europe was sealed. Europe was divided in two halves. But I was brought up in Sweden, which belonged to the western side, and I also grew up in England, where my father lives. So I was very, very amazed by how different life was behind the Iron Curtain. And when I was there, we were taught from an early age that this was the enemy. This was, you know, the opposition in the Cold War. But the people that I met were so fascinating, so full of life, and so incredibly hospitable to us. And so it woke my curiosity to try and understand, you know, how can we be so different, but at the same time so similar? So I think from that very early age, I decided that I had to try and understand all of this and try and understand Europe.
So what was the experience like to actually go to school for a time in Russia, and I believe finish your master's thesis, actually?
Mm. Yeah, so I decided there and then that if you're going to understand, you know, Europe and Eastern Europe and Russia, you probably need to learn the language, and you need to spend some time in Russia. So at university level, I studied Russian, and I spent some time in Moscow first and then in St. Petersburg. And that was the part where the book is based, which was mid-90s, 1996, to be more precise, was the time of the watershed presidential election when Boris Yeltsin managed, against all odds, to come back from a pretty bleak position in the opinion polls to win the election. You know, this was a time when Russia was pretty much lawless. And there was a lot of tension in the air, and everyone actually believed that the Communist Party, then led by a man called Zhuganov, was going to win that election. So everyone was sort of fearing that this very brief period of openness and democracy was going to end after only 5 years. But somehow Yeltsin managed to win with the help of Western forces, but also with the help of the oligarchs. And this, of course, is the social sort of backdrop to Ask No Mercy. And there's a lot of interesting things happened in this election that actually hasn't been written about so much. So I was fortunate enough to be there in St. Petersburg when it happened. And later on, I decided to write this down in the novel.
Hmm. So exactly how long has this novel, in a sense, been percolating, been sort of beneath the surface of your life, sort of waiting to finally be shaped?
Quite a long time, to be honest. It started out actually when I lived in New York for a while, and I lived there during the attacks of World Trade Center, 9/11.
Wow.
So my first attempt at writing this story actually started the days after 9/11, when I lived in my Manhattan apartment, and I had experienced the terrible catastrophe firsthand. I mean, we lived close to World Trade Center. We lived beneath the line that was sealed off for a few weeks or months after. And everything stopped. Everything stopped in New York, people just, especially us expats from the UK or from Sweden, we just sort of, you know, we sat in cafes and talked and tried to understand what had happened. And for me, I felt this great urge to just sit down and write, to try and understand what was going on. And my thoughts traveled back to Russia and the fall of the Berlin Wall and the fall of the Soviet Union, because that, up until 9/11, was the biggest sort of historic event of my life. And it certainly formed my upbringing and my understanding of the world. So there I was on Manhattan writing about the collapse of the Soviet Union, pretty much. And that turned out to eventually, 15 years later, it became Ask No Mercy.
Hmm. We're speaking with Martin Østerdahl, and his first novel is indeed titled Ask No Mercy. It was a enormous bestseller in Sweden and has been published elsewhere as well. It is just now published in a new English translation by Peter Sean Woltemad and available now to American listeners. So I want you to talk about your main character, Max Anger. And one of the things I also want to confess as an out-of-touch American is that as I'm kind of thinking about the life of this man named Max Anger, it makes me realize that I think most Americans never stop to think about a nation like Sweden being engaged in intelligence and counterintelligence and espionage and that kind of thing. I think we often tend to think of that as something that only the superpowers are engaged in. I mean, not that Sweden isn't a perfectly significant country in some respects, but it's not a superpower in that respect, of course. What can you tell us about this kind of activity in a nation like Sweden?
Well, I mean, to Swedes, and in Sweden, especially Russia, has always been considered the arch enemy, and this goes back way, way back into history. If you take Max Anger, the protagonist of the book, he's raised on an island called Arholma outside of Stockholm, in the archipelago of Stockholm. Stockholm is surrounded by about 30,000 islands, and Arholma is one of them. If you go to this island today, you'll find that at the northern tip of it, there's a huge military base. It's abandoned now, but it's a gigantic sort of construction inside the mountain. At the top of the mountain is a huge cannon pointing to the east. And it's still there if you want to go and see it.
Wow.
And also, if you walk around the cliffs of this island, you'll find inscriptions in the stones from the time when Peter the Great invaded the island in the 1700s and put the whole island on fire. So to the people on the coast, on the east coast of Sweden especially, there's always been an awareness that on the other side of that sea is the gigantic country of Russia, and it's always in our history been our arch enemy. So we've always had to keep an eye. There's a saying that goes around in those areas that if you're from there, you always sleep with one eye open, and it's always open to the east.
Mm. So one way in which the nation of Sweden has its collective eye open to the east is through a think tank called Vector, which does perpetual research on Russia in order to understand what they might be doing. And your main character works for Vector, as does a woman who eventually disappears. Tell us more about their relationships and the mysterious circumstances of her disappearance.
Well, they're a couple, and I think they were united in many things. But one of the things that they really both stand very firmly for is the freedom of everyone to live a free life. And Pashi, as she's called, the Russian girl that Max is in love with, she is from Russia. She's from an area of the Ukraine, actually called. She's a Tatar, so she's a minority, a Russian minority. And then, of course, in recent years, when this book was actually eventually published, what happened was that Putin and Russia invaded that part of the Ukraine and reclaimed it as Russian territory. This is Crimea, as I'm sure you're aware. And she has a personal history of having her grandfather being taken away one morning by Stalin, as so many minorities were, to be deported somewhere to do pretty much slave labor in some gigantic infrastructure project somewhere in the Soviet Empire. And this is something that has really plagued her upbringing, and she's fighting for the freedom of all Russian people, and in that she's very much united in Max, because Max has a similar kind of background with a very mysterious family situation. He doesn't know who his grandparents are. All he knows is that his father was placed on this small island called Arholm outside of Stockholm, but beyond that, he doesn't know anything. He doesn't know who his grandparents were and how it happened that his father was placed there as a foster child. So he's trying to sort of dig into the past and find out who he really is, and Pashi is doing the same. So that those two things really sort of unite the two of them. And of course, at the outset of this book, Max has tried to dig deeper into what happened to his father and his grandparents. And as he does that, suddenly Pashi goes missing in St. Petersburg. She's working for Vector in St. Petersburg, and he's working in Stockholm. So he sets off to try and find her. And obviously, he senses that there might be a connection to his mysterious family past and the reasons why she has been kidnapped.
Right. And of course, it's especially frightening and difficult for him to be undertaking this search in a place like Russia.
Yeah, and especially at the time, because there's no one you can trust. It's not like you can go. You can't go to the Swedish consulate or the Swedish embassy. You can't go to the police. You know, heaven forbid. So basically, you have to go and look for yourself, and that's what he does.
Mm. I love the way that journey is painted with ominous signs at every turn. It's marvelously crafted. I want to be sure to ask you a question, kind of on behalf of all Americans. When we think about a nation like Russia, which of course is very much in the news and has been over the last couple of years, chiefly for the very very clear evidence indicating that Russian operatives were very directly involved in our most recent presidential election, and of course certain matters that are currently under investigation. I think Russia, as you said at the outset, is one of those nations that has a certain sort of mystique about it, and we view them very warily and also tend to view them with grave suspicion, yet fascination and intrigue. Mm. How do you think, how would you advise us as Americans to sort of think about the nation of Russia? And how different is the Russia of today from the Russia that you are describing in your novel?
Wow, that's a big question. I think as far as advice is concerned, I think the picture that often portrayed of Russia in media is a simplified one. I think what one has to realize that Russia is an enormous country. It's pretty much, you know, like a world in itself. And there are so many different Russias, so many different Russian people as well. And of course, I think to anyone who really wants to increase their knowledge and understanding of Russia and the world, history is a good place to look and to try and look deeper than what you might find in the daily newspapers. And also in popular culture, you quite often tend to find quite sort of single-dimension descriptions of Russians. But it's a very complicated country. The time of the 90s, in which my book is taking place, was a very positive time period in many ways, because, you know, with the fall of the Soviet Union and with Gorbachev, who started it all with his perestroika and his glasnost, the openness to the West, I think we all felt a sense of opening and a sense of near, you know, a nearing of Russia and Europe and the West, which was, it was really a time of great optimism, but also great concern. I mean, in this part of the world, in Sweden and Scandinavia, we were very concerned that the Russians would just, you know, come in hundreds of thousands and leave this poor country that had collapsed and immigrate to our countries in huge volumes. Of course, that never happened. And the reason for that is that the Russians are very proud and they love their homeland. They love their country and their culture very, very much. And they consider themselves to be a high culture, you know, one of the high cultures of the world. And the fascination with Russia is something that we all in Sweden we very much feel. It's not only that we fear them and consider them the arch enemy. We're also very fascinated of their high culture. They're enormously successful and prolific in sports, in all forms of arts and entertainment and literature and so on. So there's a lot to admire about the Russians. And they are very patriotic, so they never did leave the Russian soil in any great numbers, and they do love Mother Russia, and there are a lot of explanations for why, but the culture is very different from the rest of Europe.
Well, it's a beautifully crafted novel. I am most impressed. As I read it, I kept. Sort of exclaiming to myself in wonder that this is your first novel, and clearly all of your work as a director over the years has taught you a lot about what it means to tell a good story, what it means to entertain, and your novel is certainly all of that and more. I assume you are very excited at the prospect of it taking shape as a series for television as well.
Absolutely. I mean, that is a dream come true. And I'm very excited about it.
The novel, again, is Ask No Mercy. It is published by Amazon Running and the author, Martin Østerdahl. Martin Østerdahl, I enjoyed this opportunity to speak with you, and I wish you well with all of your future endeavors.
Thank you very much.
It's 8:32, and you're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's morning show is out of the archives. We'll enjoy it in just a second. We will be talking for the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show about gratitude. And there may not be anything that is more central to our happiness as human beings and our overall well-being than a sense of gratitude. And gratitude is something that seems to maybe come fairly naturally to some people and not so naturally to others. And maybe even if someone feels an inclination to be grateful, to live a life of gratitude, that doesn't mean we always know what it is that we should be grateful for, or the best ways to express our gratitude, or the ways in which an attitude of gratitude should sort of permeate our being. I mean, is it something we should sort of artificially apply to the way we live, something that we do dutifully, almost as if by rote, or is it supposed to spring out of the heart of our emotions? There is a lot to think about, actually, when it comes to the matter of gratitude. And I'm very grateful for a book called Grateful, The Transformative Power of Giving Thanks. And it is written by Diana Butler Bass, who has written a number of different books before this, and probably she's best known for her book Grounded, and has also written Christianity After Religion and Christianity for the Rest of Us, among other works. And She speaks all across the country on a number of different issues related to various facets of our spiritual lives. And again, her latest book published by HarperCollins is Grateful: The Transformative Power of Giving Thanks. Diana Butler Bass, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's good to be here.
I'm really happy to be talking with you. And I think right off the bat, we should probably take a moment to say that you are writing this book, at least in part, from your own personal perspective as a person of faith, and certainly informed by what your own religious faith happens to be, which is Christian. And yet this is not a book that is intended just for Christian readers. And you really, I think in a really beautiful way, invite people of other faiths to take on this topic and explore it in your book within the context of wherever they happen to come from. Can you just say a word about that?
I'm glad you start with that, because one of the things that has become a hallmark of my work in recent years is the capacity to express my identity as a Christian and to draw deeply out of the wells of wisdom from the Bible and from Christian theology, but also to create that broader table, because I very strongly feel that a person of faith can be comfortable and friends with people from all kinds of different perspectives, and that to live together well in a good pluralistic society, which sometimes I think we're not doing so well right now, but we need more models of that. How do we live well together with people of difference? Is really a passion of mine. And so as a writer who happens to be a Christian, I'm always reaching toward other people and trying to listen to other stories and set the biggest table I can of folks who want to engage important issues related to spirituality and faith in our culture.
Hmm. As you write at one point specifically about gratitude, gratitude is not the exclusive possession of any single way. Rather, it is truly a path that welcomes all. And again, you welcome anybody and everybody, people of various faiths and people who have no particular religious faith whatsoever, to, in a sense, come to the table and think about this matter of gratitude.
I just was going to follow up real quick. Years mm-hmm. ago, I was a columnist for the New York Times Syndicate, and one of the most popular pieces I wrote, and this was in the late 1990s, was a piece on Thanksgiving and how Thanksgiving as a holiday might hold the ability of becoming the very best American holiday, because it was the only holiday that we have on the calendar that isn't either completely secular or belongs to a single religion, like, you know, Christmas or Easter. And so I was just thinking that you know, in the late 1990s, that Thanksgiving really stood there as a possible way of celebrating gifts and abundance and all these good things, and meanwhile having your, you know, your Jewish in-laws and your Catholic cousins and your Buddhist neighbors, you know, all at the same table. So I think that it is not only incumbent upon, like, Christians to welcome people, but for Christians to recognize that thanks and gratitude is central to all these different great world religions, all of which are present in the United States now, and we're reaching together, you know, to try to make better communities. And so it's a really important thing in terms of social and communal cohesiveness to be able to learn to work together and find those places of commonality that we share.
Right. I could not agree more. I was a little surprised that the book begins as it does with, in a sense, you very much calling into question your own sense of gratitude, or maybe not so much now, but certainly in times past, and especially as a youngster growing up, you really kind of highlight the ways in which, as a youngster, you really weren't as grateful as you should have been, and even as you grew out of childhood, that this continued to be a matter that really was kind of a source of trouble for you as much as anything. I mean, that you have struggled to be grateful for a fairly significant portion of your life. Can you tell us more about that struggle and also why you thought it was important to kind of lay that out right at the outset of your book titled Grateful?
Part of my actual struggle with writing this book was that I never really liked gratitude books very much. So here I wound up writing one, which is just a huge, huge irony. And my first suggestion for a title for this book was actually No Thanks. And then some sort of subtitle that would say, you know, a journey from being an ingrate to learning to appreciate the good things of life or something like that. It really was born in the midst of my own feelings about not knowing what to do with gratitude and feeling a bit scolded, frankly, by self-help books and even within my own church community. You should feel grateful. You should feel grateful. And I didn't know what people were really talking about. And so I share some of those moments at the beginning of the book about my own senses of inadequacy when it came to gratitude, including, you know, fighting with my mother over writing thank you notes, kind of giving up on the whole thing about gratitude, you know, in general. It's not that I have been a rude person. You know, if someone would hold a door open for me, I'd certainly say thank you, or I knew how to take flowers to a dinner party, you know, or, you know, basic kinds of courtesies. But I really didn't get it on a deep level. And so there is a lot of discussion at the beginning of the book about feelings of ingratitude, why it is that some of us seem to struggle to get to a place of feeling grateful, what gratitude really is, and what blocks it. And those things were very important for me to be able to clear those decks and realize that gratitude isn't just something that people are imposing on me from the outside, but it is this very deep, as you said in your introduction, very deep human response. And the simplest way that I've come to define it through the project and now that I've been speaking about it so often on the road in the last couple months is that gratitude is our emotional and ethical response to gifts. And that's actually an amazing definition, and it's very simple and complex at the same time. That when someone, the universe, God, gives us a gift, we as human beings have some sort of response to that. And gratitude is the response, a feeling of appreciation, a feeling of the recognition of the giver and of the gift, and then the emerging question, well, what do we do when we have received the gift? And so that's what gratitude is. And it is really important. It is very, very important. It shapes that responsiveness to understanding where gifts are, who givers are, is something that really shapes our lives. And I've learned to pay more attention to it in recent years, partly by clearing away so many of the false understandings that I had about gratitude.
Right. Including you spell out at one point how in some places or circles or traditions, gratitude was thought of as a transaction of debt and duty, but you call us to think instead about this model of gratitude being about gift and response, about responding to the gifts that we are given one way or another that are a part of our lives. And I also appreciate, as you were talking about, how you've often not been a fan of some of the books that have been written in the past about gratitude. You talk about how, in many cases, gratitude has been seen as a feminine virtue. Gratitude has been feminized. And that would even be evident in the way that the typical book about gratitude would look, in terms of the daisies on the cover and the pastel background and a lovely feminine-looking font, that we often tend not to think about gratitude in a sense in sturdier terms that is applicable to anybody's life, including a life that's had some difficulty in it.
Yeah, that is a very interesting and almost intractable problem around gratitude. Many of the studies on gratitude show that women are more grateful than men are. And indeed, I'm really sorry to have to tell you this, but since you read the book, it won't be a surprise to you, but the listeners, it may be a surprise to them. There was actually an international academic study that was conducted on the gender basis of gratitude, and American men were, of the people included in the study, the least grateful group. And they didn't posit why that would be. They simply did the research and discovered that of this worldwide population of men and women, American men were the least grateful. But I go into that a bit in the book, and I think it is related to what you just pointed out, is that typically we think of gratitude in the United States as a structure of debt and duty. That is, if you give me a gift, I'm in your debt until I discharge it. And when you take that structure of debt and interlace it with American individualism, it becomes pretty easy to see why American men feel very awkward with gratitude, because gratitude is a feeling of dependence. It's dependence on the giver who has given you something, and then you're dependent upon that person until you discharge the debt. And what if you're not able to discharge the debt? I tell a story about a young pastor in the book who, in his 40s, his little children, he's a Methodist minister, and he gets cancer. And it was a terrible experience for him. It was a death. It actually will kill him someday. He's not cured of it, but it is completely under control, and they think it will be under control for a while. But going through that, they literally thought he was going to die. And what happened was he and his family became very dependent upon the gifts of the congregation. The congregation was paying their bills, was making their meals, it was taking him to his doctor's appointment. He recounts a story where he threw up in people's cars coming back from chemo. And I heard him preach the sermon the day he came back from being on sick leave, and he said how much he hated receiving gifts because he felt like it would put him in other people's debt. And then he went on to say that this whole experience of having cancer taught him that's not what gratitude is all about, that gratitude is not a structure of debt, but instead it's a structure where the community simply shares from its compassion, the community shares its love, and that no repayment is ever expected. And that experience changed his entire understanding of gratitude. And so we have this story of, it's really a testimony, of a young man telling why, you know, he hated gratitude because it was about debt and duty, and it undercut his sense of independence and authority, you know, as a man. But then he had an experience where he had to learn it completely differently. And so in American culture, we have tended to universalize that experience so that men have a very difficult time with what they think gratitude is because of indebtedness. But that's not what gratitude really is. Gratitude isn't about debt. Gratitude is really about free gifts, givers freely giving to other people, people who are the recipients, receiving with joy, and then from that sense of joy, from that sense of giftedness, passing on to others. There is no debt involved. It's about gifts and response. And so when you ask the question about women and the feminine virtue, I think because of American culture, women were just more able to understand that idea of sharing and creating a circle of sharing. And we're less fearful of ideas about dependence and independence than American men have been. So oftentimes gratitude has been consigned to a more, quote-unquote, feminine sphere. I don't always like that language. I say that in the book, but that's where we've put it. Now it's time to understand that it's not like that. Hmm. It's not a hearts and flowers thing. It's actually the idea of gifts in response and what that can do for us as individuals to strengthen us and to strengthen social ties and strengthen our sense of wellness and strengthen our capacity to care for others. That's actually very powerful, and it's very needed right now, especially in our political and social environment.
Right. In fact, as I read your book and talked, and especially as you kind of explored gratitude in sort of the social sphere and gratitude on a community level and even on a wider canvas than that, it reminded me of a well-known book written not too long ago called The Politics of Resentment, and how many of the choices that a whole lot of people made in the voting booth in the last couple of years was fueled very powerfully by a sense of resentment. And in some ways, resentment feels like close to, if not exactly, the opposite of gratitude. And in a sense, if resentment is sort of at the core of our being and fueling many, maybe most, maybe all of the choices we're making at the ballot box and otherwise, that really says something about who we are as individuals and who we are collectively as a nation.
Yeah, and resentment is one of the things that actually blocks gratitude. And if we think about what causes resentment, there are a lot of different factors. I think there's legitimate resentment, you know, when there is a culture or an economic system that literally takes away from people who are working hard. You know, none of us likes that, and we feel resentment that we feel like we should be paid better, or we shouldn't have, our money distributed in ways that we don't really like. And so people get angry about, say, things like taxes. But it's not just about taxes. You know, there are other things that you can resent. You know, it's not good. I work as an independent contractor, and functionally, I have not gotten a raise since 2008. You know, I'm a middle-class person. I'm an author, and I do speaking engagements. And it's really awful that I'm essentially making the same amount of money that I did 10 years ago. And I kind of resent that some days, you know, that our economic system really is pushing people down. When, for example, my parents had always told me that I would do better because I had gone on to college and that I was better educated than they were. And so there were certain kind of cultural expectations I had that could have fueled resentment. I happen to be a liberal Democrat, which comes out in the book, and I'm very generous and very open about talking about politics. I like, in the same way I consider a table with Buddhists and Muslims and Hindus and Jews and atheists, I'm happy to sit around a table with conservative Republicans and independents, you know, as well. I'm a very ecumenical person in this way. But I think that piece, you know, about resentment, economic resentment, you know, it's very strong in our culture. And you say, well, hey, what's there to be grateful for? One of the things I do in the book is I reframe some of these questions. And I needed to reframe gratitude as a political capacity, because if somebody tells you you must be grateful, you know, I mean, it would be possible. When I just said I felt resentful that I haven't gotten a raise in 10 years, it would be possible for somebody to, I think, move in and say, well, you should be grateful for what you do have. And then, right, you feel terrible. It's like, oh, my, I must be a real scumbag, you know. okay, so I didn't get a raise, but I am not thankful enough for what I do have, and so I'm a terrible person. So that's not the way I want people to approach these things. One of the things I discovered as I wrote this book is the idea of this gifts and response, is that we really are surrounded all the time by gifts. We often don't notice them. We just haven't been attuned to the gifts that are present in the world around us. And so gratitude opens us up to see that, to see it more widely. And part of the reason we don't attune to gifts is because we are sort of brainwashed, I think, as Americans into a culture of scarcity, that I have to get mine, and that if I get mine, you know, I'm going to get ahead of all these other people, and my family will be taken care of, and I will be taken care of. But there's a different capacity in the universe, and that is something we all learned when we were little kids, and that's the idea of sharing. As a Christian, the biblical story is just full of this kind of thing. You know, Jesus shows up on a hillside with a bunch of his friends, and there are 5,000 people waiting for them, and they have some bread and a couple of fish. And everybody who's there is hungry, and they don't have enough to feed the crowd. And what they could have done in the story is that Jesus and his friends could have huddled and said, well, you know what, we got to feed ourselves first before we can take care of the rest of this crowd. But that's not the way it works. Jesus instead stands in front of the crowd, blesses the loaves, blesses the fish, and just instructs his friends to start passing out the food. And in the story, there's enough. There's enough when there doesn't seem to have been enough. And that's what I keep thinking about our politics and our economic situation right now in America, is that we're just not seeing it correctly in some ways, is that if we really understood what gifts were, how abundant this land is, how creative its people are, there really would be enough. And like on that hillside so long ago, that's reported in the Bible, we don't need like a savior to come and do a miracle, because I don't really think the miracle was that Jesus made two fish into, you know, 2,000 fish. I think the miracle was probably as Jesus blessed it, people's eyes were opened. They began to see all the food that was around them. They might have actually come with their own food, and they began to share it with everybody who was there. And so what seems like resentment at first, there's not enough. If you learn to reframe it in gratitude, oh, maybe there is enough. But I'm just not seeing how that works out right now. And if we can really begin to live back into some of these really simple, beautiful things about community, about abundance, and recognize, really, the United States is a very wealthy place. It's that wealth has been badly distributed. People feel left out and understandably angry about that. And so to clear the decks from that anger, to open ourselves up to that, to creativity, and to really find compassion once again for each other, no matter where we are and who we are, I think that's part of the pathway toward our communal salvation. And gratitude points the way to that. Mm-hmm.
Diana Butler Bass is the author of Grateful, The Transformative Power of Giving Thanks, published by HarperCollins. If you're interested in hearing more of my conversation with Diana Butler Bass, you can go to WGTD.org and in the Morning Show archive, find my conversation with her that aired back on July 9th of this year. Tomorrow on the Morning Show, a look back at the brutal Battle of Antietam in the Civil War. I will be speaking with the author of a fascinating book called A Fierce Glory. And on Wednesday, we'll be hearing from the co-authors of a book called The Seven Laws of Enough, Cultivating a Life of Sustainable Abundance, appropriate for this Thanksgiving holiday week. Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees, transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admission/transfer. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information is available from jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea.